Hello, dear listeners, and welcome back to Flight Through Entirety, the only Doctor Who podcast produced exclusively for work units by work units. Praise the company. I'm Brendan.
I'm Nathan.
I'm a 17 steamed dumpling for this episode.
And 17 steamed dumplings are only served in Megropolis 6 in The Sunmakers.
Or is it Megropolis 1? I'd love to say I love this story. Do you all love this story?
Yeah.
I do.
If Nathan's not going to find it tiresome, I'll have to jump in. It should be great. It's Louise's favourite story. But, you know, as a boy, there are lovely moments and beautiful lines. But this is the kind of the point for me that some shows are better done by Nick Briggs on Big Finish, and this is one of them. When they don't have a budget, you've got to sit and look at it. And I'm sorry, you've also got to look at people standing in a car park with a few machines going blink, blink. The arguments between Manfred, if that's what his name, Manfred Mann, and everybody else about who's going to be the most vicious underling in a my dad's bigger than yours and I'm going to get you first.
Oh, do you mean Ventress from Heartbeat?
Oh, God, it's interminable. So, yes, I get to be Nathan today. I think it's just because the costumes look like a Blue Peter puppet theatre reimagining of Fritz Lang's Metropolis, but with bumblebees. Like, the gatherer, how it is meant to be an Aztec thing, and there were like Aztec moments. Okay, let's talk about why this is great. Isn't it good?
I thought I might take the opportunity to leap in and agree with you on some of these things. This is a story I like. That might be my favourite story of the season.
Mm-hmm.
But the production is lamentably bad. And it's something that they seem to get right next season. I think next season has more hits. You know, they can't have any more money, but it just generally looks better. But here the production fails. Those white corridors are terrible.
And I've got lots to say about the longest white corridor in Doctor Who history before or after. That is the longest corridor shot you'll ever see, and don't you feel every single centimetre of it?
you wonder why they don't shoot that on videotape too, so that it looks like, you know, it's an interior. They've done that before.
You're right about next season. I think that there'll be a big change, a big difference now that those budget blowouts from Hinchcliffe and his epicanthic folds. How much do latex epicanthic folds actually cost?
They're very expensive, and they will cost you your soul as
every time John Bennett blinked, he'd tear the mask in two, so, you know.
Yeah, well, apparently, yeah, as you probably covered with Todd, that Wang Chung, that terrific 80s group, just paying them for the rights for the name, talents of Wang Chung, chewed up so much of the budget for the future. Isn't Hinchcliffe a monster if we haven't even covered that yet? This is the third companion who was going to be killed. Leela was going to be absolutely minced in this one.
Were they going to steam her?
Yep, she was actually going. I don't know about the final thing. We'll have to look up the notes again to check. But she was going to die. The Brig was going to die in the original Hand of Fear writing. Mm-hmm. And, of course, Sarah was going to be killed in Seeds of Doom in the compost mincer.
Yeah. Although this was actually Graham Williams considering killing Leela. So they were considering killing her in the steam sequence. So they were going to subvert the usual cliffhanger.
Thank you.
By having the companion die instead. And then Robert Holmes objected, because he was still around and he wrote this script on his way out.
It's noted as Tony Reid, as Anthony Reid, it's actually Holmes's last full job of doing everything, apparently.
And also, they were considering killing Leela in the collector's office. You know when Leela runs through that door when the doctor tells her not to and she gets zapped?
Yeah, that is strange. I'm not surprised to hear that, actually.
Yeah, they were considering killing her.
How do you both feel that would have worked out on screen, considering the tone of the rest of the season and the impact of Leela herself as a character?
It would have just been a terrible idea, in my opinion.
It sounds like an episode of Blake 7.
Yes,
We'll get to that, because this is almost an episode of Blake 7.
I'm kind of loading that statement.
It's even got Villa in it.
He's great.
Yeah, Michael Keating as Gowdry. It's got the woman who plays Veet is in a Blake 7.
Which is a hair removal cream.
Yeah.
In Australia. Yes, I wanted. It's a dilipidary cream and a new series of Julia Louis-Dreyfus. Same difference.
It's also got Tom Kelly in it, who we've mentioned before. Yeah. So he was killed in the Face of Evil. He is Nova. So he gets stuck in a wall by Leela in the Face of Evil. He gets stuck in a wall in the first episode of Blake 7. He gets stuck in barbed wire in the second Sapphire and Steel story. And here he gets stuck under a mound of revolving work units.
Yeah. Can't complain about variation of career prospects. Is this his very last performance?
No, he appears. He appears in The Invasion of Time. And his appearance
under a sand dune, under a piece of moulded fiberglass furniture.
Well, he gets trapped in some tin foil in The Invasion. Todd would
can't wait for that one.
Todd. Richard, we have a rare occurrence here. I believe Todd agrees with you, and he's about to fly in and give some comments.
It'll come as no surprise to you that as a child, I really disliked this story as much as the other Robert Holmes classic, The Carnival of the Monsters. And I would have given this one 2 out of 10 as well. I really, really disliked all the stuff underground, and I really thought it looked really cheap. But I did quite like Marn. In my middle age, I actually think this is a really funny script, and I think there's some wonderful performances, especially by those underground. But I ask you, what audience is Bob Holmes actually directing this story to? Because I actually don't think it's the traditional Doctor Who audience. All right, well, look, I've got some cooking to do. I've got to go and put a turkey in the oven. I have to let it baste in its own juices, and I don't want it to overcook and get too dry. Well, it doesn't really matter, because next week I'm going to be serving up turkey, whether it's dry or moist. A turkey is still a turkey.
Todd nailed it twice. Thank you, Todd. We have to thank Pennant Roberts. He got a lot of the director of the story. He got a lot of, you know, slack later on in fan circles, mostly for his 80s stories, which didn't quite hold up so well, and there's a reason for that, and I don't think it's Pennant Roberts.
He's not good here.
Well, I don't know that he's terribly bad. I just think there's no budget and no time. Mm. But there is one line he makes which is gorgeous. But Pennant Roberts, the character of Marn, was written for a man. And Pennant Roberts, in every story he's done, has replaced the major secondary character with a female actor. And full points for that.
She's not a great actor, though. She's the secretary, though. Do you know what I mean?
But she's also cold and vicious. Look, I agree.
I like her a lot. I think she's terrific. And there's a moment where the collector is getting very excited about the prospect of steaming Leela.
there's a website for that.
She's kind of horrified by him and scared of him, and she sells that really well. And her final scene where she's deciding to join the rebels, she's also really funny in that scene. I think she's good.
No, look, she's superb, and I can see why Louise loves this so much. And Pennant Roberts, the other line, we go back to the corridor, is he said, you know, this was filmed at the big old tobacco factory outside of London. It was called, what was it called? The Hartcliff Whiffy or something. But he was trying to tell the actors how to stomp about under PCH, you know, the pentosilenic methylhydrane gas, which you must experiment with at school. It's the dental thing. But anyway, wandering about with that, they said, well, you know, how do you want us to do it? One of the, you know, fortunate extras who was trying to make his mark. He said, well, just look around at all the workers here in this factory. Mm-hmm. And he said, I doubt that they're just smoking tobacco. they were looking so bored and wondering for their jobs to die.
Pylene 50, actually.
But exactly. If we can just throw back to why Todd, the second point of Todd's question is that he doesn't like this as a boy. I did like this as a boy, but it was also instantly forgettable. And I think the two reasons it really works is the backup cast are so strong, because Roberts cares about his actors. Mm-hmm. It's a great audio script. It should exist in the mind. Or, have you got your drink ready? Or, as directed by Lang or Murnau, as a German expressionist film.
Hooray!
Thank you, everyone.
It's
been so long away. Those white corridors would have been beautiful with some projections on them, and just cut the lighting and make everything. You've got beautiful long white corridors are brilliant for projecting shadows onto, and all the great directors of the silent era and the early black and white know the same thing. Cut all the lights, throw some things in. You didn't need to spend half the budget on the go-go gadget mobile mystery van thing that they're all trundling around in at 0.3 k an hour trying to look terrified.
Yeah, so Pennant Roberts can direct.
It's so stupid. But it's great because you can recreate it in Lego, as Brendan's already done for us with our Dimensions game we've got on the table. Yeah, so lighting really lets it down. Pennant Roberts, I think, is a great actor and theatre director. He's not a great visual director, and it's so unwatchable because I've always said, Doctor Who, it's not what it looks like, but I was wrong. If this was a relationship, we'd all be in counselling now. I was wrong. It's almost unwatchable.
See, I agree with you to a point, certainly with the film sequences, but in the studio I do think Pennant is trying to get that expressionistic side. Like, if you look at Gatherer Hayes' office, it's sort of a bunch of freestanding shapes in a black void.
On a black negative space. Yeah,
yeah, lots of negative space. Same in the steaming room, and similar in the collector's office, which is a bit lighter, but you've got all those wonderful panels, which, yeah, again, are, yeah, evoking that sun symbol.
Yeah, and it works, that kind of idea of just using flats and drapes works so well in, yeah, Celestial Toymaker. It's obvious that it should have worked as well again. I'm absolutely giving no shrift on this.
I mean, can we talk about this? Because this is a very, very angry Bob Holmes.
Mm. It's a great story.
And it's part of a big tradition, which I think does start with, say, the Savages or the Macra Terror, the Happiness Patrol, Gridlock,
yep,
where the Doctor overthrows like a tyrannous regime in one day. He arrives, yes, and tears down an evil political system.
Mm.
And all of these stories are really allegorical. All of these stories have just wafer-thin premises. Do you know what I mean? Like, if you were sort of a crazy, obsessive Doctor Who fan, Richard,
for example,
would you be able to fit this into the sort of continuity of Earth's Empire? You know, at some point we all go to Pluto and then we all come back. You know, we don't care.
It's so far in the future, yeah, they don't even acknowledge an Earth or that there's
They do mention it and
Earth.
Talk about going back to it, I think, at the end.
As if it's a lost icon. But I like where you're going with this.
What we have here, and the story goes that Holmes got a big tax bill and he was really irritated. He's, you know, kind of politically conservative, Holmes, and we've been cross at him for various things in the past.
Mm.
But this doesn't read as a satire of the tax system. This reads as an attack on capitalism, and the Doctor overthrows a vicious capitalist regime just in one day. So the company gets spoken of. It's not the government, it's the company. The Collector talks sort of presciently like an 80s Gordon Gekko. An ongoing insurrectionary situation wouldn't be, you know, good for, you know, seen as positive for the company and stuff. He talks like a corporate drone. All of that sort of stuff makes it read as an attack on capitalism. And it's really funny. It's just terrifically funny. It's packed full of hilarious lines. It gives Leela something to do. The reason Louise likes it is those scenes at the beginning of episode 2 where she's trying to encourage people to go and rescue the Doctor and, you know, everyone's a coward and stuff. And she's speaking in thundering Shakespearean iambic pentameters.
Go on, Brendan, chime in.
Revolution!
Revolution! Yay, hooray for Vicky. But no, I do love that scene as well. And I especially love it for when Cordo volunteers and she says, "You're the bravest person here."
Yeah, no, there's some beautiful lines. I love Cordo. The reason this is such a great script, and as you say, it's interesting to talk about precedents, but the reason this story works and the other ones you've talked about working as well, it's always been a terrific story. It was a terrific story 25 years before when it was written by Frederick Paul and Cyril Cornbluth in 1953. I had this as I read a lot of SF as a teenager locked in my room. It was called The Space Merchants, and it's a really standout book. You can still get it in print, and you can certainly download it on whatever device you care to use. The reason it's so well known is that Kingsley Amis, the father of Martin Amis, and the great literary critic and poet and huge James Bond fan. We may well have mentioned him on Bondfinger, and I will so again. He called this book, The Space Merchants, the greatest SF novel in English when it came out, and everybody else agreed. The Prime Minister agreed. It's about, the basis of this, if you haven't read it, is the advertisers running the world and the consies, or conscious people, who are the and the consumables, the consumers, I should say, underneath. And it's almost plotline for it is this story.
Oh.
And it's well recognised that it's you know, by the folk at the BBC, and they thought, oh, how witty of you to rewrite this. And, of course, this whole period in Doctor Who was about rebooting. It's also the first revolution, I'll come back to it, it's the first revolution I think we've had since Reign of Terror of the Tellurians.
It reminds me of the Savages, where they smashed the system in episode 4.
Yeah, that's true.
And kind of the Crotons, but I get the Gons aren't human. And really, the Gons wouldn't have done it themselves.
Well, it is like the
there.
Crotons, though, isn't it? Because it is mixing up.
Holmes's first thing. Let's make acid. Holmes has always been, for an ex-cop, he's always been surprisingly really red flag.
Yeah.
socialist.
I think like Gene Roddenberry in a way, because Gene Roddenberry, creator of Star Trek, was an ex-police officer as well.
Yeah, there's something about having been on the street, isn't there?
Yeah.
Like
yeah,
a prostitute. I think that's yes. where that cynicism comes from, yeah. that Holmes writes with.
Yeah.
But here he's taking it somewhere positive, like he does actually have a sort of proper message. And then next year he'll do an anti-colonialism thing. Like, we do think of him as a conservative, but these are surprisingly progressive stories for him.
Yeah, I think he's perhaps a conservative in the way that some people now are trying to distance, some conservatives now, I should say, are trying to distance themselves from the very right-wing conservatism we see, where they say, I'm a conservative in the sense that I want people to have a family. I don't care the makeup of that family, but I want people to have a family and people who love and support them, and I want people to be able to succeed on their own success.
We've got Whigs and Tories again, just as Thatcher wanted 19th century politics, we've got it, yeah.
Something I want to say to illustrate Todd's question of who is the audience for this.
That's a great...
The novelisation of this story was, of course, written by Terence Dix. And it's kind of blow-by-blow what happens in the script, but there is a bit that Terence Dix adds, which is towards the end when the work units, sorry, people, Cordo, throw the gatherer off the roof.
I really like that scene.
Because
it is pretty astounding to see as a child,
In the TV version, it ends with Veet saying, and we'll do the same to the collector when we see him. You know, gets a little bit Oliver.
And his little dog.
And his little dog too. But in the novel, after they throw him off, they kind of laugh. And when they finish laughing, everyone kind of looks at each other with the sense that this has perhaps gone a little bit far, but 1,000 metres is a long way down.
Oh, but that's just Terry being a bit conservative as well. I like how we enjoy the revolution, in the story.
I really like his sentiment in trying to teach morality to children, but I honestly think there'd been so much adrenaline, they would have found, what can we chuck next?
Cordo was going to throw himself off the roof in episode one, and they throw Gatherer Hayde off the roof, and that's the right thing to do.
Oh, but this is my point. We can look at that as adults and understand the allegory, and we can understand the link between those.
Yeah.
But at this point, the show is still ostensibly being made for, as Tom Baker puts it, several levels. You know, you've got the 6-year-old child who's scared of the monsters. You've got the 10-year-old child who's being brave because the 6-year-old child is scared of the monsters. You've got the 15-year-old laughing at them, and you've got the parents saying, isn't that enjoyable?
Mm.
Really, I would say this story would more appeal just to the 15-year-old and the adults. There's no monsters. God, now I'm Nathan.
But Holmes very frequently doesn't do monsters.
Yeah, that's
we
true.
Will talk about. That's true. We've talked about that before, but you know, his two stories next year feature one monster each.
Yeah.
You know, there's the magma creature.
but that's the thing. I think design-wise, this story is very much for children. People are in colourful outfits.
Well, they're dressed as Lego minifigures, presaging before they were ever invented.
Indeed. And it's canines first.
Canine's actually, we should talk about Canine. Canine's actually really enjoyable in this. I really like I really like his cynicism and his pithiness. We discover he runs on batteries. I didn't actually know that before.
I love the tail wagging and the tail drooping thing. Yeah. I think it's so cute. And then Leela goes completely out of character and says, you know, Canine announces that he's done something. She goes, what do you want, Canine? A biscuit?
But it's still very, very witty.
Yeah. No, you can see the actors. This is an actor's piece, and it really works for actors. It's just such a sad thing. It's honestly, it's a minor point, but it just shows us what the medium is of Doctor Who, and that there are lines you can't cross. It's a perfect theatre piece, and with black drops and simple lighting, it would have worked really well on stage. It requires an intimacy between the screen and the audience, and it doesn't achieve that. It actually pulls us away from the drama. We care little. The only person we really care about is Leela. And Cordo, again, not necessarily. It's the way he's framed. It's interesting that, and the reason I mention Metropolis and German Expressionism is actually a reason. It's not called Megropolis for no other reason. Yeah. There's lots of little motifs. The steam chamber that Leela is in is an exact copy of the sarcophagus that Maria the robot is in Metropolis. Yes. There are lots. The way the controller, whoever it was, is holding the controls is exactly the same way that it's figured in Metropolis, if we look at that again. He's holding these big controls and spinning the things around. There's a way that lighting and direction can either stimulate intimacy or produce an intimacy, or it can actually pull you away. And That's it. It's not. It's only one thing about this story, but it's such a big thing that I have to agree with Todd on this. I actually felt more of a separation, and it annoys me because it shouldn't. And I remember as a boy thinking the novelization. I liked this story because of that. Mm. And Lita's performance is terrific. If Louise wasn't in this, I just don't know if it would go anywhere.
I just think the script. I think the script is so clever that. This is Doctor Who. We're used to ignoring kind of terrible sets and things.
They're not always a separation. They're usually an integrative thing. We were talking about this earlier, that, you know, you often feel as if you're dressing up with your mates or you're play acting with your mates when you're watching it when things go slightly wrong.
Yeah.
It encourages a kind of sympathy in the audience for what's happening on screen because we're laughing along with them.
Yeah.
But I don't think that achieves it in this case.
I mean, part of the Williams thing is that it is pitching itself older and it doesn't have the budget and it doesn't really have the design ability, and it's had a few spectacular fails already this season. Well, one. And
so far this season.
Yeah, so far this season. And it will sort of default to a mode that requires a little bit of irony and, you know, like an audience that it is in some way detached from it and aware of its tropes and all of that sort of thing. And so you're no longer really sympathising with the characters, but you're enjoying, you know, the story and the kind of raised eyebrow and just generally the attitude. And so here, there's all kinds of really terrifically funny lines, but you're not in a world that you can really believe. You know, you don't have any characters and so on to engage with, but I think it still works. I think it's still funny and entertaining.
I think you've just hit on two things there. We're very much of an era of the postmodern theatre or the postmodern doctrine of theatre, and that we're critiquing while we're watching. You just mentioned two very interesting things. The supercilious, ironic viewing back into it. I guess we're both actually saying the same thing. Yeah. There's dissonance. Sontag writes about this, Susan Sontag, the essayist, in 70s in postmodern theatre. It came from the French and from other people. Beckett, of course, as an English writer, is probably the best one to raise, Samuel Beckett. But there's a point of the distancing or an awareness of the void between the performance and the audience, which is meant to create drama and a heightened level of tension in the audience member and discomfort. That shouldn't happen in Doctor Who.
Well, I don't think that does happen. I think, look, it's exemplified by Mary Tam next year, who just sort of strolls through the thing raising her eyebrows and just enjoying.
But we're very much part of Mary's view, and we're her silent, invisible companion next to her. I felt, to presage what's going to be coming up with you and Todd and Brendan next year, is that I'm always right there with Mary Tam as Romana. So I don't feel at all separated or distanced by her ironic glance. I find it humorous and I'm encouraged to take that view within the drama.
So because here there's no one quite like that, is that the problem?
I just honestly think there's a lot of cerebral attention, but there's not a lot of love, if we can bring it back to what would Oprah do? There's not a lot of... There's love for the ideas and there's skill and there's wit, but I don't think there's a great deal of love for the audience. Everyone's realising how clever they all are.
A sort of that old phrase of everyone's obviously having a good time, it'd be nice for us to have it too.
That's how I felt, and I'd like to hear Todd's response because I suspect that's how he was feeling as well. Yeah. But his obelisk has disappeared. I can't get him back. What did you think, Brendan?
A funny thing, I see exactly all of what you're talking about, but like Nathan, for me, the script still brings it through.
Is it enough to hold you?
It's so funny. Yeah,
I think it is. But I will also admit that those scenes in the long, white, featureless corridors, it's only the close-ups that really hold my attention. And the moments like, great Zoanna, and I said forward!
Which you know were all done in rehearsal.
Yeah.
If you watch this and go and make scones in the kitchen or something, just have this on in the other room, it's a great story.
Yeah, you know what? It's never going to be on my top 10 list, but it's a great...
It should be, though. I'm not disagreeing with Nathan. Yeah. This is a very interesting triumvirate today, isn't it? We're all sort of both disagreeing and agreeing. I'd like to know what the listener thinks. What does our friend Greg Miller think about this? I'm sure you'll write in.
An old family friend of mine who's sadly no longer with us introduced me to a great term. when I was staying at her house one school holidays, she described Star Trek IV, The Voyage Home, as her ironing movie. You know, she'd put it on and she'd do the ironing. And I think this is one of those Doctor Who stories as well. You can make the scones while you're doing it, or you can do the ironing. And the thing is, every time you do sort of tune into it, you're going to get a witty line anyway.
Yeah.
With that Doctor Who, I've got an ironing era.
Oh, yes.
It's the Pertwee era.
Of course.
You've actually mentioned that before, too. And I think I remember going, yeah. Because the outfits are so gorgeous. There's all that money and attention just on Pertwee's part is being spent on his costumes. And we know that his last season, he's just worried about his outfits.
Yes.
The nice thing here is that, look, Louise is fabulous in this. I really like the supporting cast. It's actually up there amongst my top 25 Doctor Who stories of all time. Let's go through that and give the listener great fun being able to read that on our book. No, we'll do that for Christmas.
We'll do it in reverse alphabetical order.
Yeah, absolutely.
We can all do that individually.
It's a home story, so it can never really be wrong. But there's also that fine line of when he takes the piss, and he does, out of everyone and everything, including his performers, there's a little bit of distance. And at this point, for me, it's just grown that much too far. I would like to add, though, that I'm really surprised at the amount of compassion we're getting from Holmes, because we don't always get that. I don't think we're ever going to get it again in the future from him. But the 2 points, the one that you say that he was the one that was dead against, or was it Williams? The one that was dead against writing off Louise in this story. It's a complete volt face. I'm really surprised to hear Holmes. Maybe he's learnt from the very recent lessons that you just don't do that to an audience of children.
Yeah,
you can do it with Matthew Waterhouse. I'm really looking forward to seeing how we review that one.
Because he doesn't matter.
Well, I don't think anyone cares.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, and also he's one of us. He was a 15-year-old boy. Yeah. And even teenagers don't like other teenagers.
Yeah. It's funny you saying that no one cares, because when we get there, I have two stories about that of two people who cared a great deal about the death of Patrick.
One of whom is Matthew Waterhouse.
Mm-hmm. Well, three then in that case.
Okay, but back to this one.
You know, I mean, we talked about this being a revolutionary thing, but the Usurians, who obviously get their name...
Usurians.
The practice of charging interest. When the collector looks the Doctor up in his database, he learns that the Doctor has a long history of violence and economic subversion.
And that the Time Lords are not bankable to deal with. What the hell were they ever considering dealing with the Time Lords? And how do they know this information? Did the Time Lords actually have some kind of congress with these seaweed? Because they're actually a fungus, aren't they? They're a fungus with eyeballs. It's very Kenny Everett.
Well, I think it's just Holmes being rude about the Time Lords again. Now that he's died and smashed them up in the Deadly Assassin, he's just going to be brutal about how ineffectual they are. And, of course, it does, spoiler alert, kind of prefigure what we get at the end of the season.
It does, and I'd actually like to go backwards as well. Have you realised that it's the only other race that uses the term Tellurians are the Lurmans in Carnival of Monsters?
Yeah.
So I would really like to think that the Usurians and the Lurmans are somehow related, and that free collective bargaining is the greatest sin in the galaxy.
The TGP, the Transgalactic Pact.
Yes. Sure, we'll hear no more of that. Well, we never heard anything about it. It's a secret, haven't we?
Something I love about the end of this story, of course, is that, you know, you've had the science fiction trope in Doctor Who before of Doctor talks a computer to death. So, you know, we had that in The Green Death.
Yeah, I blame Zoe for that.
Yeah,
she started it, didn't she?
We kind of had that in The Face of Evil, although he also zapped it to death with some buttons. Here, the Doctor doesn't talk the computer to death, the computer talks the villain to death.
Yeah, what does he do?
He's too.
He feeds a small, you know, negative growth rate into it or something.
Yeah, yeah. He makes him buy a house in Sydney and then undercharge for the rent.
It's that crazy thing, making fun of economics, and it is something that will become standard in the 1980s. It's a bit early for it here. But, you know, there's too many economists in the government, you know, my dear. What you need is a Wiley accountant. All of that sort of terribly funny stuff about economics, which Doctor Who has never gone to before. And here it is, just a few years too early.
Mm.
that point you raised about sympathy. You feel sympathy for every character except the Collector. You even feel sympathy for the Gatherer.
And how good is Henry Wolfe? We've really got to throw in...
It is that thing, you know, we've had this thing, it's going to come up because it's a Williams-era theme, where they'll write a funny script and then the actors will come in and mug and do big voices and be terribly silly. But here it really works. Like, both Gatherer Haight and the Collector are huge comedy performances. But they work.
And I think it works so well because Marne is played so straight.
Maybe you're right.
And she's just got all those reactions in the background of, oh, God, are you really doing... Okay.
And she's perfect Hitchcock sitcom society blonde.
Yes.
She's the budget Grace Kelly in this. So her role is to be impassive and lovely. It's almost Felicity Kendall, Penelope Keith era sitcom stuff, isn't it? Mm. Henry Wolfe, who's the Collector, you know?
I mean, he's just terrific. And all of those sort of huge pompous Holmesian things that Gatherer Haight does, like calling him your enormity and your corpulence and stuff like that, is just terrific, just terribly funny, and it doesn't undermine the satire.
He's still with us, you know, Henry Wolfe.
What about, who was Gatherer Haight?
No, Gatherer Haight, Richard Leach, has passed on, sadly. Yeah. But no, Henry Wolfe is still with us and still acting.
Yeah, Henry Wolfe was appearing in a show called Words and Pictures as the librarian helping children to read, and in Rutland Weekend Television, which was kind of like an early version of The Fast Show or something, a faux review show, as various con men and transvestite continuity announcers. Right while this was on.
He was like frocking up as Joyce Grenfell or something.
I can only wish. It's been a while.
Well, we're taking off from Pluto now. That's all the time we have for The Sunmakers. We will be back next week to take on Doctor Who's biggest adventure in CSO ever, Underworld.
I'm very excited.
Yeah, I can feel the excitement from here. Please do check us out at flightthroughentirety.com, Flight Through Entirety on Facebook and iTunes, and FTE Podcast on Twitter. You can also check us out on Bondfinger, where we have a variety of comedy
and drunkenness
about the first few Sean Connery James Bond films. You can find that at bondfinger.com, Bondfinger on Facebook and iTunes, and Bondfingercast on Twitter.
We were never as drunk as Connery was.
I think between us, though, we've got enough hair.
Just.
Don't leave it in too long, it goes frizzy.
Until next week, may none of your steam baths be controlled by a bunch of CK with eyes. Thank you very much and good night.
Good night.
Good everyone.
That was Flight Through Entirety with Nathan Bottomley, Brendan Jones and Richard Stone. This episode, Don't You Feel Every Single Centimetre, was recorded on the 11th of October 2015. The next episode will be released on November 22nd. I can sympathise with the Collector. I get a real feeling of job satisfaction when my broccoli is perfectly steamed.
I think it's the phones interfering with
could
it.
Could be. It could be, yeah. Okay, it seems to be all right.
I won't be able to teleport up in an emergency if my Apple Watch is on airplane mode. Can it teleport?
I love how when Big Finish started doing Liberator Chronicles, everyone complained, you've recreated the teleport sound, and they had to be very diplomatic and say, that's because it comes under the auspices of a piece of music. It doesn't exist as a clean recording. And we would have to pay the original composer for its use, and that's all sorts of legal trouble when we could
so
just
they,
redo
they,
it.
So they remade the sound of it.
They remade the sound
Does
of it.
Does it sound different?
Very slight. You know, it sounds like a really clean version of the recording.
I don't remember it sounding that different.
No,
I've
exactly.
heard the whole first season.
It's a bit like their...
Are they good or are they terrible?
Oh, I love them.
Yeah.
Really? They're better. But look at what you're comparing to. They give everyone better work. Callie is a much more interestingly written character.
So they get Jan Chappell.
It's everybody.
That everyone who's alive except for Gisette Simon.
Because she's not in that season. She is coming up, though.
So season two,
They've done a season three set as well. And
they get Angela Bruce back again?
Well, no, the whole thing is Dana has taken an escape pod and no one knows where she's gone. So it's the search for Dana, and she's replaced by Tom Shadbon as Del Grant.
Oh, really? Wow.
Yeah.
That's so crap.
I'm usually really positive about everything, too.
Yeah, no, leave it in.